Okay, I would like to welcome everybody here today and welcome also our television audience by way of Shaw Cable. My name's Bill Ramp. I'm a professor of sociology at the University of Lethbridge and was also doing a study recently on the funding of community agencies from gambling revenues. And in the course of that, I talked to a number of people involved in community agencies here in town, one of them being Gordon Lee from the John Howard Society. And I was fascinated enough by what he had to say that I thought to myself, I got to give this guy a platform and let him talk about some of the things that he's encountered in his work and some of the issues he sees. And lo and behold, we have him here today. A few household duties to start with. The cost of the luncheon is $8, and what you do is you just put $8 in the little basket that is on your table, and that will be collected at the end. I'd like to acknowledge our sponsors, Shaw TV, the University of Lethbridge, the Lethbridge Herald, and Erickson's Restaurant for making these events possible, and especially also the volunteers, the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs. And if anyone here isn't volunteering or hasn't volunteered for the Southern Alberta Council and would like to, please talk to me at the end and I'd be happy to set you up. Now the format for today, presentation by Gordon first off, about 25 to 30 minutes, followed by lunch, and then a little later than we had thought, but probably about 1:10, we'll bring Gordon back up here for questions. So, to introduce Gordon today, I'd like to start off with a Lethbridge Herald story this morning, the title of which is Harper Pledges Crime Crackdown, and this announces three bills that the federal government is introducing to crack down on crime, one of which involves, let me see if I can just find it here very quickly, to introduce separate bills to impose mandatory prison sentences for serious, repeat, and violent crimes, abolish conditional sentences and house arrest, and raise the age of consent. Now, what interested me is what Harper said in introducing these bills, which was basically to the effect that the opposition parties really wouldn't dare vote against these. Because these bills, the implication is, have the weight of Canadian public opinion behind them. But Harper is on side with public opinion. Now, I think it's safe to say that we all would like to see less crime, and especially less violent crime in our society. We'd like to see the costs of crime come down. The question is, do we know what we're doing when we call for a crackdown on crime? Do we actually know what works and what doesn't work? And what Gordon is going to talk about today is both some of the causes of crime and some of the effects on inmates, on people who are convicted of crimes, which then rebound back on us in the community. So what he wants to talk about is the way in which our strategies for dealing with crime, or sometimes our lack of strategy for dealing with crime, can actually cost us more in ways that we don't commonly think of. And so without further ado, I'd like to introduce Gordon Lee to talk about being locked in and locked out.
Well, thank you, William, for that build-up. I'll try to meet the expectations that you have drafted for me and see what I can do. I work for the John Howard Society. I've worked for the society. Is it not on?
In toward the mic.
I see. I gotta be like do that pop star thing and go like this into the mic. Okay. Because it's being recorded, I suppose. Speak up. Is that okay? Can you hear me now?
Yeah,
you know, I was once giving a talk, and a gentleman at the back did call out and say that he couldn't hear me, and a person at the front said they could hear me quite well and didn't mind changing places, so we'll see how we do this time around. This doesn't give me the opportunity then of casually glancing down at my notes, because they're obscured by the microphone. So the impression that I was going to try and create of being a very knowledgeable person and who could speak off the cuff has now been has been taken away from me. So if you don't mind, I'll kind of have to do this as part of what I'm going to do. So we can get started. I think Bill's set the scene fairly well. I noticed in the initial release that you had, Bill, that you'd used the fact that we often hear this common cry that crime is on the increase and that we need more police and more enforcement and more, as you just quoted from the Herald today, crackdown, or quoting the Prime Minister, crackdown on crime. And if you really think about it, that argument that crime is on the increase and we need more police, which has been going on for years and years and years, is a flawed statement, because if we've been giving all these police and more police and more police and more crackdown and more crackdown, and yet crime is on the increase, then obviously it hasn't worked. And it isn't working. So there's something odd about that statement that I've never really understood, but you hear it often enough. So the question is, you know, is crime on the increase, and will more crackdown, whatever that means, crackdown, going to solve the problem of crime? We know that the causes of crime are complex and we'll take a look at a little bit of this. We can't do what the equivalent of a course in criminology would achieve. But some things about causes of crime are fairly easy to understand. So let's look then if crime is on the increase. I did pull down the statistics for the last 4 years, from 2000 to 2004. The 2005 statistics are not available yet, from Statistics Canada. And there, in criminal code offenses, there has been an overall decrease. Crimes of violence are down. Homicide is a relatively stable, a very, very slight increase in homicide, but attempted murder is down. I should mention, when we talk about homicide, don't forget that 66% of all homicides are domestic, and another 30% are business-related, often through business partners. So if you're married and in business, then watch out. Just keep buying those lottery tickets, because your chances of winning there are probably greater. Attempted murder is down, assaults are down, levels 1 to 3, that's the serious assaults, to the lesser assaults. Sexual assault is down, other sexual offenses are down quite considerably. Robbery is down, the lump other crimes of violence category is minusculely up. Those would be fighting in pubs and so on. Property crimes are down. Breaking and entering is down. Motor vehicle theft is a little bit up. Theft over 5,000 is substantially down. Theft under 5,000 is down. Possession of stolen goods is up a little bit, and fraud is up a little bit. So for the kinds of crimes that we hear a lot about, the crime rate is actually been going down for some considerable period of time. Criminologists have known this, but the media appears to always represent the fact that crime is on the increase. As a matter of fact, that impression that crime is on the increase is caused to a large extent by media. The Sentencing Commission, some time ago, when it was looking at the issue of sentencing as part of reform in the justice system, through its survey of 800 newspapers across Canada, found that of news reporting, as opposed to your sports and entertainment and stuff, but of news reporting, 60% of the content of news reporting is about violence, 30% is about murder. So it's an absolute distortion of reality in reporting news. And you can do it yourself, even with, you don't even need a stopwatch, with your hand watch, if you watch the TV networks and just see how much reportage there is that is about violence across the world of one kind and another, and also violence in Canada and murders in Canada. It's quite startling once you actually start to time it and look at the proportions. So we create this impression, you see, that we're all under threat and things are getting worse, you're likely to be murdered in your sleep or awake, and the statistics simply don't bear that out, and anyone who's read Boom Bust Echo would know the demographics of that, that crime has been on the decline for some considerable time. And so we suffer from the trauma, the impact of that. And there is impact from that. We know from post 9/11 that there was an increase in reported depression amongst particularly the population of the United States, and also in the number of suicides. There was quite a steep increase because of actually with the broadcasting of that event. The same thing happened in 1929 with the crash of the stock market too. That there's no use pretending that this kind of reporting does not create trauma in the population as a whole. Some of the facts seem to bear out the fact that it does. So the question is then, do we somehow expect the justice system to, you know, provide some magical solution to all this? Or, you know, what is our expectation of the justice system? We know from recent studies that the causes of crime are usually long range and find their roots in poverty, in lack of effective parenting, neglect and abuse in children, lack of stable employment in families, where there's alcoholism in families or drug addiction in families, that these are the root causes of crime. They become known as the health determinants, and the health determinants were developed during the 1990s, not only as pointers to the causes of many types of social ailments and pathologies, but crime in addition to the other social pathologies that we see around us. This is where attention needs to be directed if we're going to actually reduce the level of crime, to address these issues, neglect and abuse, family violence, family breakup, proper parenting, proper health. It's been shown that that children who don't receive appropriate nutrition, suffer from more ailments, coughs and colds and earaches and flus that keep them away from school. And the compounding effect of all this, of course, is that they fall behind and get labeled as failures. Sometimes have to repeat a grade. Ultimately. Drop out early, 14, 15, 16, become entangled with a similar peer group, engage in use of alcohol and experiments with drugs, and the cycle begins. But it has long-range beginnings to sort of crack down on it at that point. Is to punish something that's not entirely the fault of the individual. But somehow we expect the justice system to reverse all that. You know, those 10 and 14 and 16 years of causation in a brief sentence of 60 days in prison or 90 days in prison or even 18 months in prison. They're simply not possible. During the 1990s, the Crime Prevention Council of Canada, which is a magnificent body, produced a wonderful body of work in the form of research and some wonderful publications, indicated quite clearly that these health determinants, as they're called, deficits, where there are deficits in the health determinants, are causal to crime. In a massive way, and they spearheaded the method of what was called social development in Canada, methods of dealing with these things that existed for some time in other countries such as Scandinavian countries, where money is invested, truly invested, in humanity at these target points. Neglect and family violence and unemployment, lack of education, and so on, in order to have a reducing effect later on. It was found from long-range studies in Scandinavia, for instance, that the investment of $1 in this kind of process in social development paid off $3 later on in terms of tax savings. Or savings to the public purse, if you will, not to mention the huge savings in human costs that these reductions would bring about. Both the health determinants and the social development model have received scant attention, more so the health determinants than the social development model, because the social development model means the investment of funds. But again, I repeat that why somehow we expect that the justice system or cracking down will remove these impacts of the deficits in social development is quite a surprising thing to expect from the We can point to a number of, the increase in the number of counselors, school counselors, various family counseling, police officers, school resource officers, and so on. But all these measures are after the fact, after the problem has been created. And then, of course, there's quite a struggle then to rectify long-range trauma and neglect. Now, some of the work done, statistics produced by the Crime Prevention Council, demonstrated that on long-range studies of penitentiary inmates that 65% of federal inmates test lower than grade 8, 82% test lower than grade 10, 80% of Aboriginals in the federal system test out at lower than grade 10. 75% of women in federal prisons have only achieved junior high school education, and 40% of women in federal institutions are functionally illiterate. Most of the people in federal prisons, particularly females, find themselves there for crimes of poverty, or if you like, crimes of property, especially petty theft, ongoing petty theft. 80% of Aboriginal offenders were unemployed at the time of committing their offense, and 67% of them having no previous skilled employment to actually quote from. This latest study by the Ontario government of addiction in, or what is now euphemistically called abuse, amongst inmates in Ontario prisons produced a result of 70% of the inmate population is addicted. Now, I would suggest that's a conservative figure, because if you're asking people about their addictions, quite honestly, sometimes the answers are not as forthcoming they may be minimized to a degree. My rule of thumb estimate from my work with prisoners has always been that about 80% of them are addicted to either drugs or alcohol. The prisoners themselves tell me their estimate is 90%. But in any event, whether you want to go from 70% to 90%, you've got a highly addicted population there. Now, addiction doesn't begin last week or the week before or the week before the crime or the week before the sentence. It begins at age 14. 9,000 of the prisoners tested at the federal level admitted to using alcohol at age 14 and drugs at age 16. 80% of federal female inmates identify alcohol abuse as a cause of family violence. And it goes on. The figures on family violence and abuse, 82% of federal women inmates are victims of physical and or sexual abuse. 85% of Native women in federal provincial institutions are victims of family abuse. 50% of men in federal prisons have either suffered or witnessed family abuse. They grew up in an atmosphere of violence where problems are solved by use of force. And of course, grow up imitating the same thing. Health rates are very poor amongst inmate populations in general, a very high rate of mental disorders such as anxiety and depression, psychotic disorders, 10% psychotic, 55% suffer from anxiety actually in a prison. It's hard to imagine anyone not suffering from anxiety. Now, the other thing we've got to remember is that these people are coming out, whether it's a 30-day sentence or 90 days or 90 weeks or 90 months. Other than the extreme few who will die in jail, the lifers, they're coming out. Increasing sentences will not stop crimes occurring. It might give us a moratorium where if sentences are doubled, well, someone isn't coming out for a little while longer, but they're still coming in the front door. It fills up from the back. And then once they start coming out, whether it's you go from a three-month sentence to a six-month sentence, okay, the person didn't come out in 3 months, came out in 6 months. Here we go again. They're coming out. That's the other side of the coin. What put them in there? And they're coming out. We forget about that. So now we ask the questions. Did it do any good? If it did, if there were any changes effected, if there were any changes, will these changes now be given an opportunity to take effect? There are programs in prisons. Strangely enough, I get to talk to people when they're sober. I'll quickly try to tie this up because this is the crux. When people get out of jail, there are barriers, systemic barriers to them reintegrating effectively back into society. I'll give you a couple of simple pointers. The lack of identification, picture ID as we call it. You can't open a bank account without two forms of picture ID. If you want a job where the employer pays by direct deposit and you don't have a bank account, you're out of luck. ID is necessary to get welfare, picture ID. Often people in jails don't have picture ID. Either they never did have a driving license or it was taken away from them, or they lost it. if you go to the registry office and try to buy Alberta ID, if you have any kind of fine outstanding or you owe the government any kind of money, support payments, whatever, you will not be allowed to have ID. Now, it seems to me that we're creating non-persons. We ought to be able, as citizens, to have picture ID as a right. Not as a condition, but as a right. This is the problem of the criminal record itself and bonding. Employees ask for a criminal record check. Those things cost $25 plus tax. And if they're not quite sure if you can't identify yourself sufficiently, then you'll have to go get a fingerprint check done to identify the fact that you are that person, and that's another $25 plus tax. Now, if you're on welfare, or if you have just gotten out of jail and can't get welfare because you've no picture ID, or because you're being assessed for what program you will go in, then you cannot afford a criminal record check. Many employers are asking for a criminal record check these days. And the bonding conditions have always been that, you know, if you have a criminal record, you're not eligible. It's not actually true. Bonding is about risk, and some things some sorts of record present no risk to the employer. And the federal department that dealt with this indicated that 80% of people who have a criminal record are bondable, provided that they're not, in direct conflict with the record and the particular form of employment that they are seeking. But they're instantly dismissed as having a record. Now, what's the point of going to the police, getting a criminal record check that says you have a criminal record, and then taking it to the employer who says, well, sorry, now you can't have a job? So it becomes like futility absurdity, even. So that criminal record will hold one up in a big way. Whether more police will actually cause people... Look, if the state is keeping information on me, I should not have to pay to get that information. If I have got, let's say it is a criminal record or some other form of information about me that the state has on file, I should be able to access that file quite freely. Now, I'm going to just conclude with reading you the editorial from the New York Times on March 31st, just a few days ago, a couple of weeks ago. This is the editorial, March 31st. I think I got wind of your topic down in New York there, William. So this is what the editorial said. Crippled by soaring correctional costs, states and municipalities are re-examining policies that drive ex-offenders right back to prison by barring them from employment. Locked out of the mainstream, ex-felons become burdens to their families, their communities, and to the nation as a whole. Three big cities, Boston, Chicago, San Francisco, have taken groundbreaking steps aimed at de-emphasizing criminal histories for qualified applicants for city jobs, except in law enforcement, education, and other sensitive areas, where people with convictions are especially barred by statute. The Boston plan, which becomes effective this summer, deserves to be widely emulated. It covers not just city employees, but other companies that do business with the city. These companies, which employ hundreds of thousands of workers, will be required to make their employment policies consistent with those put forth by the city. In the new policy, the city will not conduct a criminal record review at all, except in very special circumstances or when required by law. Even then, the search will come near the end of the process, after the applicant has proven to be qualified and is about to be hired. If the city then changes its mind about the job offer, the applicant is entitled to a full explanation and a chance to rebut the criminal record reports, which sometimes contain errors. Taken together, the recent developments in Boston, Chicago, and San Francisco symbolize a step forward in terms of fairness for law-abiding ex-offenders, who are often barred from entire occupations because of youthful mistakes and minor crimes committed in the distant past And I encounter that constantly with the people I deal with, that these records go back sometimes 17 years and are still disbarring people from employment. It should be clear to us, to all of us by now, that confining those people to the ranks of the unemployed makes it more likely that they will commit new crimes, return to prison, and become a permanent burden to society. So we have to ask ourselves in terms of Bill's title, locked in to locked out, whether in fact we are not systemically creating barriers which are criminogenic. Now, if we can address those early issues of crime prevention by investment and remove some of these barriers so that people will be employable, believe me, we will reduce crime. Effectively reduce crime. Cracking down on it? Kick it harder if you like. Maybe there's some word satisfaction in that. Maybe Mr. Harper, and I believe he is, maybe he is speaking for the Canadian population. But in doing so, I don't think he's speaking for the Canadian population as a whole.